She had dealt with the rising of the Rains and Tarbox had made him well-respected, even feared, throughout the Seven Kingdoms. His cousin Lady Joanna, the daughter of Lord Titus's late brother, Sir Jason, was already in King's Landing. She had been serving as lady-in-waiting and companion to Rhaella since 259 AC. She and Sir Tywin were married a year after he became Hand of the King, in a lavish ceremony at the Great Sept of Baelor, with King Aerys himself presiding over the wedding feast and bedding. In 266 AC, Lady Joanna gave birth to twins, a boy and a girl. Meanwhile, Sir Tywin's brother, Sir Kevin, had also wed, taking to bride the daughter of Sir Harris Swift of Cornfield, who had once been given to him as a hostage for her father's debts. In 267 AC, Lord Tywin Lannister's heart burst as he was climbing a steep flight of steps to the bedchamber of his mistress. His lordship had finally put aside his wet nurse, only to become besotted with the charms of a candlemaker's daughter. So at the age of 25, Tywin Lannister became the Lord of Casterly Rock, Shield of Lannisport, and Warden of the West. With the Laughing Lion at last laid to rest, House Lannister had never been stronger nor more secure. The years that followed were golden ones, not only for the Westerlands, but for all the Seven Kingdoms. There was a worm inside the apple, though, for the growing madness of King Aerys II Targaryen soon imperiled all the Tywin Lannister sought to build. His lordship suffered great personal loss as well, for his beloved wife, Lady Joanna, died in 273 AC, whilst giving birth to a hideously deformed child. With her death, Grand Maester Pycelle observes, the joy went out of Tywin Lannister, yet still he persisted in his duty. Day by day and year by year, Aerys II turned evermore against his own hand, the friend of his childhood, subjecting him to a succession of reproofs, reverses, and humiliations. All this Lord Tywin endured, but when the king made his son and heir, Sir Jaime, a knight of the king's guard, he could abide it no longer. Lord Tywin at last resigned the handship in 281 AC. For after the counsel of the man he had relied upon so long, surrounded by lickspittles and schemers, King Aerys II was soon swallowed up entirely by his madness as the realm fell to pieces around him. The events of Robert's Rebellion are revealed elsewhere and need no retelling, save to note that Lord Tywin led a great Lannister host out of the west to capture King's Landing and the Red Keep for Robert Baratheon. Nigh unto 300 years of Targaryen rule were brought to an end by the swords of Lord Tywin and his Westermen. The following year, King Robert I Baratheon took Lord Tywin's daughter, the Lady Cersei, to wife, joining two of the greatest and noblest houses in all Westeros. Casterly Rock. Casterly Rock, the ancient seat of House Lannister, is no ordinary castle. Although crowned with towers and turrets and watchtowers, with stone walls and oaken gates and iron portcullises guarding every means of egress, this ancient fortress is in truth a colossal rock beside the sunset sea. A rock that some say looks like a lion in repose when the sun sets and the shadows fall. The rock has been a habitation for men for thousands of years. Before the coming of the first men, it seems likely that the children of the forest and giants made their homes in the great sea-carved caverns at its base. Bears, lions, wolves, and bats have also been known to make their lairs within, along with countless lesser creatures. Hundreds of mine shafts penetrate the lower parts of the rock, where many veins of red and yellow gold gleam untouched in the stone even after millennia of mining. The Castleys were the first to begin to carve halls and chambers from the mine shafts, and they established a ring fort on the rock's peak from which they could survey their domain. The rock has been measured as thrice the height of the wall or the high tower of Old Town. Almost 2 leagues long from west to east, it is riddled throughout with tunnels, dungeons, storerooms, barracks, halls, stables, stairways, courtyards, balconies, and gardens. There is even a godswood of sorts, though the weirwood that grows there is a queer, twisted thing whose tangled roots have all but filled the cave where it stands, choking out all other growth. The rock even has a port inside it, complete with docks and wharfs and shipyards, for the sea has carved great caves into its western face, natural gates deep and wide enough for long ships and even cogs to enter and offload their cargoes. The Lion's Mouth, the huge natural cavern that forms the main entrance into the rock, arches 200 feet high from floor to ceiling. Over the centuries, it has been widened and improved upon, and is now said that 20 horsemen can ride abreast up its broad steps. Castle Rock has never been taken by storm or siege. No castle in the 7 kingdoms is larger, richer, or better defended. Legend says that Visenya Targaryen, upon seeing it, thanked the gods that King Loren rode forth to face her brother Aegon on the field of fire, for if he had remained within the rock, even dragon flame would not have daunted him. The lords of Castle Rock have gathered many treasures over the centuries, and the sights of the rock, especially the Golden Gallery with its gilded ornaments and walls, and the Hall of Heroes with their costly armor worn by 100 Lannister knights, lords, and kings, stand eternal guard, are justly famed throughout the 7 kingdoms, even in lands beyond the narrow sea. The Reach. The largest and most populous of the 6 southern kingdoms, the North, vast in expanse, though thinly peopled, being a land apart, is commonly referred to as the Reach, but this name is somewhat of a misnomer. The domains of House Tyrell, the Lords of Highgarden, now largely correspond with those of the Kingdom of the Reach, as it existed for thousands of years before Aegon's conquest. But that rich and fertile realm was, in fact, once comprised of 4 kingdoms. Old Town and its environs, bounded by the Red Mountains to the east and the headwaters of the Honey Wine in the north. The Arbor, the golden island beyond the Red Wine Strait, famed for wine and sunshine. The Western Marches, from Horn Hill to Night Song. The Reach proper, a vast expanse of fields and farms, lakes and rivers, hills and woods, and fragrant meadows, mills and mines dotted with small villages, thriving market towns, and ancient castles stretching from the Shield Islands in the Sunset Sea, up the mouth of the Mander, past High Garden to Red Lake, Golden Grove, and Bitter Bridge, as far as Tumbleton and the Mander's headwaters. This latter was a realm ruled by gardeners of old, and in more recent days by the descendants of their Stuarts, the Tyrells of Highgarden. It was in these green fields that chivalry was born, history tells us. The gallant knights and fair maids of the Reach are celebrated throughout the 7 kingdoms by the singers, whose own traditions first took root here as well. Once and always a great realm, the Reach is many things to its inhabitants, the most populous, fertile, and powerful domain in the Seven Kingdoms, its wealth second only to the gold-rich West. A seat of learning, a centre of music, culture, and all the arts, bright and dark. The breadbasket of Westeros, a nexus of trade, a home to great seafarers, wise and noble kings, dread sorcerers, and the most beautiful women in all Westeros. On a hill overlooking the Mander rises Highgarden, rightly hailed as the most beautiful castle in the realm. The Mander itself, which flows beneath its walls, is the longest and broadest river in the Seven Kingdoms. The great city of Old Town is the equal of King's Landing in size, and is superior in all other respects, being vastly older and more beautiful, with its cobbled streets, ornate guild halls, stone houses, and three great monuments, the Starry Sept of the Faith, the Citadel of the Maesters, and the mighty High Tower with its great beacon, the tallest tower in all the known world. Truly, the Reach is a land for superlatives. Garth Greenhand. The story of the Reach begins with Garth Greenhand, the legendary progenitor not only of the Tyrells of Highgarden, but of the Gardener kings before them, and all the other great houses and noble families of the Green Realm as well. A thousand tales are told of Garth in the Reach and beyond. Most are implausible, and many contradictory. In some he is a contemporary of Bran the Builder, Lan the Clever, Durin Godsgreave, and the other colourful figures of the Age of Heroes. In others he stands as the ancestor of them all. Garth was the High King of the First Men, it is written. It was he who led them out of the east and across the land bridge to Westeros. Yet other tales would have us believe that he preceded the arrival of the First Men by thousands of years, making him not only the first man in Westeros, but the only man, wandering the length and breadth of the land alone, and treating with the giants and the children of the forest. Some even say he was a god. There is disagreement even on his name. Garth Greenhand, we call him. But in the oldest tales he is named Garth Greenhair, or simply Garth the Green. Some stories say he had green hands, green hair, or green skin overall. A few even give him antlers like a stag. Others tell us that he dressed in green from head to foot, and certainly this is how he is most commonly depicted in paintings, tapestries, and sculptures. More likely, his sobriquet derived from his gifts as a gardener and a tiller of the soil, the one trait on which all the tales agree. Garth made the corn ripen, the trees fruit, and the flowers bloom, the singers tell us.
A few of the very oldest tales of Garth Greenhand present us with a considerably darker deity, one who demanded blood sacrifice from his worshippers to ensure a bountiful harvest. In some stories, the green god dies every autumn when the trees lose their leaves, only to be reborn with the coming of spring. This version of Garth is largely forgotten.
Many of the more primitive peoples of the earth worship a fertility god or goddess, and Garth Greenhand has much and more in common with his deities. It was Garth who first taught men to farm, it is said. Before him, all men were hunters and gatherers, rootless wanderers, forever in search of sustenance, until Garth gave them the gift of seed and showed them how to plant and sow, how to raise crops and reap the harvest. In some tales, he tried to teach the elder races as well, but the giants roared at him and pelted him with boulders, whilst the children laughed and told him that the gods of the wood provided for all their needs. Where he walked, farms and villages and orchards sprouted up behind him. About his shoulders was slung a canvas bag, heavy with seed, which he scattered as he went along. As befits a god, his bag was inexhaustible. Within were seeds for all the world's trees and grains and fruits and flowers. Garth Greenhand brought the gift of fertility with him. Nor was it only the earth that he made fecund, for the legends tell us that he could make barren women fruitful with a touch, even crones whose moon blood no longer flowed. Maidens ripened in his presence, mothers brought forth twins or even triplets when he blessed them. Young girls flowered at his smile. Lords and common men alike offered up their virgin daughters to him wherever he went, that their crops might ripen and their trees grow heavy with fruit. There was never a maid that he deflowered who did not deliver a strong son or fair daughter 9 moons later, or so the stories say. These legends, though cherished by the small folk, are largely discounted by both the maesters of the citadel and the septons of the faith, who share the view that Garth Greenhand was a man, not a god, a hunter or war chief, most like, or perhaps a petty king. He might well have been the first lord of the first men to lead his followers across the arm of dawn, as yet unbroken, and into the wilderness of Westeros, where only the elder races had previously trod. God or man, Garth Greenhand fathered many children in this new land. On this all the tales agree. Many of those offspring grew to be heroes, kings, and great lords in their own right, founding mighty houses that endured for thousands of years. Of all these, the greatest was his firstborn, Garth the Gardener, who made his home on the hill atop the Mander that in time became known as High Garden, and wore a crown of flowers and vines. All of Garth Greenhand's other children did the gardener homage as the rightful king of all men everywhere. From his loins sprang House Gardener, whose kings ruled the reach beneath the banner of a green hand for many thousands of years until Aegon the Dragon and his sisters came to Westeros. The list is long, and many are the legends, for there is scarce a noble house in all the reach that does not boast of descent from one of Garth Greenhand's countless children. Even the heroes of other lands and kingdoms are sometimes numbered amongst the offspring of the Green Hand. Brandon the Builder was descended from Garth by way of Brandon of the Bloody Blade, these tales would have us believe. Whilst Lan the Clever was a bastard born to Floris the Fox in some tales, or Rowan Goldtree in others. However, Lan the Clever's descent from Garth Greenhand is a tale told in the Reach. In the Westerlands, it is more often said that Lan cousined Garth Greenhand himself by posing as one of his sons. Garth had so many that oft-times he grew confused, thus making off with part of the inheritance that rightly belonged to Garth's true children. That Garth Greenhand had many children cannot be denied, given how many in the Reach claim descent from him. But that all other lordly houses of Westeros were similarly descended seems most unlikely.
Some celebrated children of Garth Greenhand. John the Oak, the first knight, who brought chivalry to Westeros, a huge man, all agree, 8 feet tall in some tales, 10 or 12 feet tall in others, sired by Garth Greenhand on a giantess. His own descendants became the Oakhearts of Old Oak. Gilbert of the Vines, who taught the men of the Arbor to make sweet wine from the grapes that grew so fat and lush across their island, and who founded House Red Wine. Floris the Fox, cleverest of Garth's children, who kept three husbands, each ignorant of the existence of the others. From their sons sprang House Florent, House Ball, and House Peak. Maris the Maid, the most fair, whose beauty was so renowned that 50 lords vied for her hand at the first tourney ever to be held in Westeros. The victor was the Grey Giant, Argoth Stone Skin, but Maris wed King Uthor of the High Tower before he could claim her, and Argoth spent the rest of his days raging outside the walls of Old Town, roaring for his bride. Fos the Archer, renowned for shooting apples off the head of any maid who took his fancy, from whom both the red apple and green apple Fossaways traced their descent. Brandon of the Bloody Blade, who drove the giants from the Reach and warred against the children of the forest, slaying so many at Blue Lake that it has been known as Red Lake ever since. Owen Oakenshield, who conquered the Shield Islands, driving the Selkies and Merlings back into the sea. Harlan the Hunter and Herndun of the Horn, twin brothers who built their castle atop Horn Hill and took to wife the beautiful Woods Witch who dwelled there, sharing her favors for 100 years, for the brothers did not age so long as they embraced her whenever the moon was full. Bors the Breaker, who gained the strength of 20 men by drinking only bull's blood, and founded House Bulwer of Black Crown. Some tales claim Bors drank so much bull's blood he grew a pair of shiny black horns. Rose of Red Lake, a skin changer, able to transform into a crane at will, a power some say still manifests from time to time in the women of House Crane, her descendants. Ellen Eversweet, the girl who loved honey so much she sought out the king of the bees in his vast mountain hive and made a pact with him to care for his children and his children's children for all time. She was the first beekeeper and the mother to House Beesbury. Rowan Goldtree, who was so bereft when her lover left her for a rich rival that she wrapped an apple in her golden hair, planted it upon a hill, and grew a tree whose bark and leaves and fruit were gleaming yellow gold, and to whose daughters the Rowans of Golden Grove traced their roots.
The Gardener Kings. The history of the Reach in the days of the First Men is not unlike that of the other realms of Westeros. The bounty of these green and fertile lands did not make men more peaceful nor less grasping. Here, too, the First Men strove against the children of the forest, rooting them out of their sacred groves and hollow hills, hewing down their weirwoods with great bronze axes. Here, too, kingdoms rose and fell and were forgotten, as petty kings and proud lords contended with one another for land and gold and glory, whilst towns burned and women wailed, and sword rang against sword, century after century. And yet, there was a difference, in degree, if not in kind, for almost all the noble houses of the Reach shared a common ancestry, deriving as they did from Garth Greenhand and his many children. It was that kinship, many scholars have suggested, that gave House Gardener the primacy in the centuries that followed. No petty king could ever hope to rival the power of Highgarden, where Garth the Gardener's descendants sat upon a living throne, the oaken seat, that grew from an oak that Garth Greenhand himself had planted, and wore crowns of vines and flowers when at peace, and crowns of bronze thorns, later on, when they rode to war. Others might style themselves kings, but the gardeners were the unquestioned high kings, and lesser monarchs did them honour, if not obeisance. In those centuries of trial and tumult, the Reach produced many a fearless warrior. From that day to this, the singers have celebrated the deeds of knights like Serwyn of the Mirror Shield, Davos the Dragonslayer, Roland of the Horn, and the Knight Without Armour, and the legendary kings who led them. Among them Garth the Fifth, Hammer of the Dornish, Gawain the First, the Gallant, Giles the First, the Woe, Gareth the Second, the Grim, Garth the Sixth, the Morning Star, and Gordon the First, Greyeyes. Many of these monarchs shared a common foe, for during these dark and bloody centuries, seaborne reavers from the Iron Islands dominated almost all of the western shore, from Bear Island to the Arbor. With their swift longships, the Ironborn were able to strike and depart before any response came. The raiders oft came ashore at unexpected places, taking their enemies unaware. Though the Iron Men seldom ventured far inland, they controlled the Sunset Sea and exacted cruel tribute from the fisher folk along the coasts. Having established themselves upon the Shield Islands by killing all the men they found there and claiming the women as their own, the Ironborn even raided up the Mander with impunity. King Corrid, the most fearsome of these Ironborn overlords, boasted that his writ ren, wherever men can smell salt water or hear the crash of waves. He was known as Corrid the Cruel in the Reach, and the kings who succeeded him went by such by-names as Hagon the Terrible and Joran Maidensbane. It was against these men and their followers that the kings of House Gardner contended for 3 centuries, sometimes in alliance with the kings of the Rock and the lords of Oldhelm, and sometimes alone. No fewer than 6 of the Gardner kings died in battle, amongst them Gareth the Grim and Garth the Morningstar. Whilst Giles the Second was taken captive, tortured, and cut into small pieces to bait his captors' hooks. Yet the victory was at long last theirs, and each of them pushed the domains of House Gardner farther and brought more lands and lords beneath the rule of Highgarden. That being said, many scholars still believe that the greatest of the Gardner kings were the peacemakers, not the fighters. Fewer songs are sung of them, it is true, but in the annals of history, the names of Garth the Third, the Great, Garland the Second, the Bridegroom, Gawain the Third, the Fat, and John the Second, the Tall, are writ large. Garth the Great extended the borders of his realm northward, winning Old Oak, Red Lake, and Golden Grove with pacts of friendship and mutual defense. Garland accomplished the same in the south, bringing Old Town into his kingdom by wedding his daughter to Lyman, the Sea Lion, of House Hightower, whilst putting his own wives aside to marry Lord Lyman's daughter. Gawain the Fat persuaded Lord Peake and Lord Manderley to accept his judgment on their quarrel and do fealty for their lands, without fighting a single battle. John the Tall sailed his barge up the Mander to its very headwaters, planting the banner of the Green Hand wherever he went, and receiving homage from the lords and petty kings whose lands lined that mighty river's banks. Greatest of all the Gardeners was King Garth the Seventh, the Golden Hand, a giant in both war and peace. As a boy, he turned back the Dornish when King Ferris Fowler led 10,000 men through the Wide Way, as the Prince's Pass was then called, intent on conquest. Soon after, he turned his attention to the sea and drove the last Iron Men from their strongholds on the Shield Islands. Thereafter, he resettled the islands with his fiercest fighters, granting them special dispensations for the purpose of turning them into a first defense against the Ironborn, should they return. This proved a great success, and to this day the men of the Four Shields pride themselves on defending the mouth of the Mander and the heart of the Reach against any and all seaborne foes. In his last and greatest war, Garth the Seventh faced an alliance between the Storm King and the King of the Rock, intent on carving up the reach between them. But he defeated them both, then with cunning words sowed such discord between them that they turned on one another with great slaughter at the Battle of Three Armies. In the aftermath he married his daughters to their heirs and signed a pact with each, fixing the borders between the three kingdoms. Yet even that paled before his greatest accomplishment, 75 years of peace. Garth Goldenhand became King of the Reach at the age of 12 and died upon the Oaken Seat when he was 93, still sound of wits, if frail of body. During the 81 years of his reign, the Reach was at war for less than 10. Generations of boys were born and grew to manhood, sired children of their own, and died without ever knowing what it was to grasp a spear and shield and march away to war. And with this long peace came an unprecedented prosperity. The Golden Reign, as this time came to be known, was when the Reach truly flowered. Yet all golden ages end, and so it was in the Reach. Garth Goldenhand passed from this world. A great grandson followed him upon the Oaken Seat, then gave way to his own sons. And then the Andals came. Andals in the Reach. The Andals came late to the Reach. Crossing the narrow sea in longships, they landed first upon the shores of the Vale, then later all along the eastern coasts. The fleets of Old Town and the Arbor barred them from the Red Wine Straits and the Sunset Sea. Reports of the bounty of the Reach and the wealth and power of Highgarden and its kings undoubtedly reached the ears of many an Andal warlord, but other lands and other kings lay between them. Thus long before the Andals reached the Mander, the kings in Highgarden knew of their coming. They observed the fighting in the Vale, the Stormlands, and the Riverlands from afar, taking note of all that happened. Wiser, perhaps, than their counterparts from other regions, they did not make the error of allying with the Andals against local rivals. Gwaine the Fourth, the God's Fearing, sent his warriors searching out the Children of the Forest, in the hopes that the Green Seers and their magic could halt the invaders. Merne the Second, the Mason, built a new curtain wall about Highgarden, and commanded his lords bannermen to see to their own defences. Merne the Third, the Madling, showered gold and honours on a woods witch who claimed that she could raise armies of the dead to throw the Andals back. Lord Redwine built more ships, and Lord Hightower strengthened the walls of Old Town. Yet the great battles most of them had anticipated never came to pass. By the time the conquerors were done conquering the eastern shores, generations had passed, and the Andals had raised up 20 petty kings of their own, many of them at odds with one another. And in Highgarden, the three sage kings followed one another upon the Oaken Seat. Garth the Ninth, Gardener, his son Merle the First, the Meek, and his grandson Gwaine the Fifth, were very different men, but they shared a common policy towards the Andals, one based on accord and assimilation rather than armed resistance. Garth the Ninth brought a sept into his court and made him part of his councils, and built the first sept at Highgarden, though he himself continued to worship in the castle Godswood. His son, Merle the First, formally espoused the faith, however, and helped fund the construction of septs, septries, and motherhouses all over the Reach. Gwaine the Fifth was the first gardener born into the faith, and the first to be made a knight by solemn rite and vigil. Many of his noble forebears have had posthumous knighthood conveyed upon them by singers and storytellers, but true knighthood only came to Westeros with the Andals. Both Merle the First and Gawain the Fifth took Andal maidens as their wives, as a means of binding their brides' fathers to the realm. All three kings took Andals into their service as household knights and retainers. Amongst those so honoured was an Andal knight named Sir Alistair Tyrell, whose prowess at arms was such that he was made the king's champion and sworn shield under Gawain the Fifth. Sir Alistair's descendants in time became the hereditary Stuarts of Highgarden, under the Gardeners. The three sage kings also found lands and lordships for the more powerful of the Andal kings descending on the Reach, in return for pledges of fealty. The Gardeners sought after Andal craftsmen as well, and encouraged their lords' bannermen to do the same. Blacksmiths and stonemasons, in particular, were handsomely rewarded. The former taught the first men to arm and armour themselves in iron in place of bronze. The latter helped them strengthen the defences of their castles and holdfasts. And though some of these new-made lords forswore their vows in later years, most did not. Rather, they joined with their liege lords to put down such rebels and defended the Reach against those Andal kings and war bands who came later. When a wolf descends upon your flocks, all you gain by killing him is a short respite, for other wolves will come, King Garth the Ninth said famously. If instead you feed the wolf and tame him and turn his pups into your guard dogs, they will protect the flocks when the pack comes ravening. King Gawain the Fifth said more succinctly, they gave us seven gods, we gave them dirt and daughters, and our sons and grandsons shall be as brothers. Many noble houses of the Reach trace their ancestry back to Andal adventurers given lands and wives by Garth the Ninth, Merle the First, and Gawain the Fifth. Amongst them the Ormeys, Perrins, Gracefords, Cooys, Roxtons, Offerings, Laygoods, and Varners. As the centuries passed, the sons and daughters of these houses intermarried so freely with those descended from the first men that it became impossible to tell them apart. Seldom has a conquest been achieved with less bloodshed. The centuries that followed the Andal conquest were to prove less peaceful. The Gardeners who succeeded to the oaken seat included strong men and weak, clever men and fools, and once even a woman. But few had the wisdom and cunning of the three sage kings. So the golden peace of Garth Goldenhand did not come again. In that long epoch between the assimilation of the Andals and the coming of the dragons, the kings of the Reach warred constantly with their neighbours in a perpetual struggle for land, power, and glory. The kings of the Rock, the Storm Kings, the many quarrelsome kings of Dawn, and the kings of the rivers and hills could all be counted amongst their foes, and oft-times amongst their allies as well. Highgarden reached the apex of its power under King Giles the Third Gardener, who led a glittering host of armoured knights into the Stormlands, smashed the armies of the aged Storm King, and conquered all the lands north of the Rainwood, save for Storm's End itself, which he besieged without result for 2 years. Giles might well have completed his conquest had not the King of the Rock swept down upon the Reach in his absence, forcing him to lift his siege and hurry home to deal with the Westermen. The broader war that followed involved three Dornish kings and two from the Riverlands, and ended with Giles the Third dead of a bloody flux, and the borders between the realms restored to more or less where they had been before the bloodletting began. The Nadir of Gardner Power came during the long reign of King Garth the Tenth, called Garth Greybeard, who succeeded to the crown at the age of 7 and died at 96, a reign even longer than that of his famous forebear, Garth Goldenhand. Though vigorous in his youth, Garth the Tenth was a vain and frivolous king who surrounded himself with fools and flatterers. Neither wise nor clever, his wits abandoned him entirely in old age, and during the long years of his senility, he became the tool of first one faction, then another, as those around him vied for wealth and power. His grace had sired no sons, but Lord Peake had married one of his daughters, Lord Manderley another, and each was determined that his wife should succeed. The rivalry between them was marked by betrayal, conspiracy, and murder, finally escalating into open war. Other lords joined in on both sides. With the lords of the Reach at sword point, and the king too feeble to grasp what was occurring, much less stop it, the Storm King and the King of the Rock seized the moment and large swathes of territory, whilst the Dornish raids grew bolder and more frequent. One Dornish king besieged Oldtown, whilst another crossed the Mander and sacked High Garden. The oaken seat, the living throne that had been the pride of House Gardner for years beyond count, was chopped to pieces and burned, and the senile King Garth the Tenth was found tied to his bed, whimpering and covered in his own filth. The Dornish cut his throat, a mercy, one of them said later, then put Highgarden to the torch after stripping it of all its wealth. Almost a decade of anarchy followed, but in the end 20 of the great houses of the Reach, led by Sir Osmond Tyrell, the High Steward, made common cause, defeated both the Peakes and Manderleys, reclaimed the ruins of Highgarden, and placed a second cousin of the late and unlamented Garth Greybeard upon its new throne as King Mern the Sixth Gardener. Though a man of modest gifts, Mern the Sixth had able counsel in his Stuarts. Sir Osmond Tyrell was succeeded in that office by his son, Sir Robert, and later by a grandson, Laurent. Relying on their acumen, Mern the Sixth ruled well, rebuilding Highgarden and doing much and more to restore House Gardner and the Reach. His son Garth the Eleventh did the rest, taking such a terrible vengeance upon the Dornishmen that Lord Hightower said afterward that the Red Mountains had been green until Garth painted them with Dornish blood. For the remainder of his long reign, the king was known as Garth the Painter. And so it went, king after king, in war and peace. Yet through it all, the Green Hand flew proudly across the Reach, until King Mern the Ninth rode out to meet Aegon Targaryen and his sisters upon the Field of Fire. Oldtown. No history of the Reach is complete without a look at Oldtown, that most grand and ancient of cities, still the richest, largest, and most beautiful in all Westeros, even if King's Landing has eclipsed it as most populous. How old is Oldtown, truly? Many a maester has pondered that question, but we simply do not know. The origins of the city are lost in the mists of time and clouded by legend. Some ignorant septons claim that the Seven themselves laid out its boundaries. Other men, the dragons, once roosted on the Battle Isle until the first High Tower put an end to them. Many small folk believe the High Tower itself simply appeared one day. the full and true history of the founding of Old Town will likely never be known. We can state with certainty, however, that men have lived at the mouth of the Honey Wine since the Dawn Age. The oldest runic records confirm this, as do certain fragmentary accounts that have come down to us from maesters who lived amongst the children of the forest. One such, Maester Jellicoe, suggests that the settlement at the top of Whispering Sound began as a trading post, where ships from Valyria, Old Gis, and the Summer Isles put in to replenish their provisions, make repairs, and barter with the elder races. And that seems as likely a supposition as any. Yet mysteries remain. The Stony Island, where the High Tower stands, is known as Battle Isle, even in our oldest records, but why? What battle was fought there? When? Between which lords, which kings, which races? Even the singers are largely silent on these matters. Even more enigmatic to scholars and historians is the great square fortress of black stone that dominates that isle. For most of recorded history, this monumental edifice has served as the foundation and lowest level of the High Tower. Yet we know for a certainty that it predates the upper levels of the tower by thousands of years. Who built it? When? Why? Most maesters accept the common wisdom that declares it to be a Valyrian construction, for its massive walls and labyrinthine interiors are all of solid rock, with no hint of joins or mortar, no chisel marks of any kind, a type of construction that is seen elsewhere, most notably in the Dragon Roads of the Freehold of Valyria and the black walls that protect the heart of Old Valentus. The Dragon Lords of Valyria, as is well known, possess the art of turning stone to liquid with dragon flame, shaping it as they would, then fusing it harder than iron, steel, or granite. If indeed this first fortress is Valyrian, it suggests that the Dragon Lords came to Westeros thousands of years before they carved out their outpost and dragonstone, long before the coming of the Andals or even the First Men. If so, did they come seeking trade? Were they slavers? Mayhap seeking after giants? Did they seek to learn the magic of the children of the forest, with their green seers and their werewoods? Or was there some darker purpose? Such questions abound even to this day. Before the doom of Valyria, maesters and archmaesters often travelled to the Freehold in search of answers, but none were ever found. Septon Bass claimed that the Valyrians came to Westeros because their priests prophesied that the doom of man would come out of the land beyond the Narrow Sea, can safely be dismissed as nonsense, as can many of Bass' queerer beliefs and suppositions. More troubling and more worthy of consideration are the arguments put forth by those who claim that the first fortress is not Valyrian at all. The fused black stone of which it is made suggests Valyria, but the plain, unadorned style of architecture does not. For the Dragon Lords love little more than twisting stone into strange, fanciful, and ornate shapes. Within the narrow, twisting, windowless passages strike many as being tunnels rather than halls. It's very easy to get lost among their turnings. Mayhaps this is no more than a defensive measure designed to confound attackers. But it, too, is singularly un-Valyrian. The labyrinthine nature of its interior architecture has led Archmaester Killian to suggest that the fortress might have been the work of the Maze Makers, a mysterious people who left remnants of their vanished civilization upon Loreth in the Shivering Sea. The notion is intriguing, but raises more questions than it answers. An even more fanciful possibility was put forth a century ago by Maester Theron. Born a bastard on the Iron Islands, Theron noted a certain likeness between the black stone of the ancient fortress and that of the sea stone chair, the high seat of House Greyjoy of Pike, whose origins are similarly ancient and mysterious. Theron's rather inchoate manuscript, Strange Stone, postulates that both fortress and seat might be the work of a queer, misshapen race of half-men, sired by creatures of the salt seas upon human women. These deep ones, as he names them, are the seed from which our legends of Merlins have grown, he argues, whilst their terrible fathers are the truth behind the drowned god of the Ironborn. The lavish, detailed, and somewhat disturbing illustrations included in Strange Stone make this rare volume fascinating to peruse, but the text is impenetrable in parts. Maester Theron had a gift for drawing, but little skill with words. In any case, his thesis has no factual basis, and may safely be dismissed. And thus we find ourselves back whence we began, forced to concede that the beginnings of Old Town, Battle Isle, and its fortress must forever remain a mystery to us. The reasons for the abandonment of the fortress and the fate of its builders, whoever they might have been, are likewise lost to us. But at some point we know that Battle Isle and its great stronghold came into the possession of the ancestors of House Hightower. Were they first men, as most scholars believe today, or did they mayhaps descend from the seafarers and traders who had settled at the top of Whispering Sound in earlier epochs, the men who came before the first men? We cannot know. When first glimpsed in the pages of history, the Hightowers are already kings, ruling Old Town from Battle Isle. The first Hightower, the chroniclers tell us, was made of wood and rose some 50 feet above the ancient fortress that was its foundation. Neither it nor the taller timber towers that followed in the centuries to come were meant to be a dwelling. They were purely beacon towers, built to light a path for trading ships up the fog-shrouded waters of Whispering Sound. The early Hightowers lived amidst the gloomy halls, vaults, and chambers of the strange stone below. It was only with the building of the fifth tower, the first to be made entirely of stone, that the high tower became a seat worthy of a great house. That tower, we are told, rose 200 feet above the harbour. Some say it was designed by Brandon the Builder, whilst others name his son, another Brandon. The king who demanded it and paid for it is remembered as Uthor of the High Tower. For thousands of years thereafter, his descendants ruled Old Town and the lands of the Honeywine as kings, and ships from the world over came to their growing city to trade. As Old Town grew wealthy and powerful, neighboring lords and petty kings turned covetous eyes upon its riches, and pirates and reavers from beyond the seas heard tales of its splendors as well. Thrice in the space of a single century, the city was taken and sacked, once by the Dornish king, Samwell Dane, the Starfarer, once by Corrid the Cruel and his Iron Men, and once by Giles the First Gardener, the Woe, who reportedly sold 3/4 of the city's inhabitants into slavery, but was unable to breach the defences of the High Tower on Battle Isle. The wooden palisades and ditch that had protected the city heretofore, having so obviously been proved inadequate, the next king of the High Tower, Uther II, spent the best part of his reign surrounding Old Town with massive stone walls, thicker and higher than any seen in Westeros to this point. This effort beggared the city for 3 generations, it is written. But such was their strength that later reavers and would-be conquerors were persuaded to seek for plunder elsewhere, and those who did presume to attack Old Town did so to no avail. It was not so war that the High Towers were brought into the Kingdom of the Reach, however, but through long negotiations and marriage. When Lyman Hightower took to bride the daughter of King Garon the Second Gardener, whilst giving his own daughter's hand in marriage to her father, the Hightowers became bannermen to Highgarden, reduced from wealthy but relatively minor kings to the greatest lords of the Reach. Old Town was the last of the ancient realms to bend the knee to Highgarden. Not long after, the last king of the Arbor was lost at sea, allowing his cousin King Merin the Third Gardener to make the isle part of his domain. By the terms of the marriage treaty, the Gardeners also undertook to defend the city against any assault by land, which freed Lord Lyman to turn his attention to his great purpose, the building of ships and conquest of the seas. By the end of his reign, no lord or king in all of Westeros could match the strength of House Hightower at sea. A great statue of Lyman Hightower stands overlooking Old Town's harbour to this day, gazing off down Whispering Sand. The last Hightower king is still remembered as the Sea Lion. Lord Lyman's descendants shared his vision, with rare exceptions. They tended to their own gardens and their own city, avoiding entanglement in the endless wars of the petty kings, and later of the Seven Kingdoms that emerged. "Highgarden defends our backs," Lord Jeremy Hightower said once. "So we are free to gaze outward to the sea and the lands beyond." Gazing outward and building ever more ships to protect his trade, Lord Jeremy doubled the city's wealth. His son Jason doubled it again and rebuilt the High Tower 100 feet taller.
The origins of the Citadel are almost as mysterious as those of the High Tower itself. Most credit its founding to the second son of Uther of the High Tower, Prince Perimor the Twisted. A sickly boy, born with a withered arm and twisted back, Perimor was bedridden for much of his short life, but had an insatiable curiosity about the world beyond his window. So he turned to wise men, teachers, priests, healers and singers, along with a certain number of wizards, alchemists, and sorcerers. It is said the prince had no greater pleasure in life than listening to these scholars argue with one another. When Perimor died, his brother, King Urrigan, bequeathed a large tract of land beside the Honeywine to Perimor's pets, that they might establish themselves and continue teaching, learning, and questing after truth. And so they did.
When the Andals came, the Hightowers were amongst the first lords of Westeros to welcome them. "Wars are bad for trade," said Lord Dorian Hightower, when he set aside his wife of 20 years, the mother of his children, to take an Andal princess as his bride. His grandson, Lord Daemon, the devout, was the first to accept the faith. To honour the new gods, he built the first sept in Old Town, and 6 more elsewhere in his realm. When he died, prematurely, of a bad belly, Septon Robeson became regent for his newborn son, ruling Old Town in all but name for the next 20 years, and ultimately becoming the first High Septon. The boy he raised and trained, Lord Tristan Hightower, raised the Starry Sept in his honour after his passing. In the centuries that followed, Old Town became the unquestioned centre of the faith for all of Westeros. From the dark marble halls of the Starry Sept a succession of High Septons don the Crystal Crown, the first of which